Hey guys, this is Will Durst, and you can catch me at the Playroom Theater in Midtown doing my little show, Durst Case Scenario Midterm Madness, from November 7th through the 18th. And now, welcome back to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By. Oy vey!
Oh, shalom, my friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And boy, oh boy, I love talking to funny people. And we have a hilarious human being on the telephone with us now. It's not just me saying this. He is a multi-time nominee for the American Comedy Awards Stand-Up Comedian of the Year Prize. And he's been doing this for many years. His books and recordings have titles like The All-American Sport of Bipartisan Bashing and Raging Moderate. He has his latest stand-up solo show. It's called Durst Case Scenario Midterm Madness. Now, usually you have to go all the way to California to see him. You gotta schlep to San Francisco. But no, he will be in Midtown Manhattan at the Playroom Theater, November 7th through the 18th. His name is Will Durst, and we are delighted to have him in the neighborhood. Shalom, Will!
Thank you so much, Rabbi. How are things?
Yeah, things are okay. I mean, you're my age-ish. Do you have the physical things, the ailments, the prostate, the tennis elbow?
Every morning there's something different.
Oh my God. But when you're on stage, do you feel anything? What I mean is, if you're sick or if you have an ailment, your back is hurting, do you forget it for like 75 minutes because there's just, you cannot feel ill on stage?
Yeah, I think it has to do with the singular focus. I think it has to do with somebody else relying upon me, that I forget my troubles and I focused on, you know, the other people involved, which is the audience or the owner of the theater or the people working there. But then afterwards, you feel worse.
Oh, is it harder? I think you're in your 60s, am I correct?
Yes, I am.
Or is it different from when you were doing it when you were in your 30s and 40s?
Yeah, I have to prepare a lot differently. I can't drink a beer at a ball game and then go on and perform that night. I have to eat well. I have to eat. Make sure I eat a couple hours before the performance. Yeah, I have to prepare. I have to, you know, because I expend a lot of energy in those 90 minutes on stage.
Yeah, I don't understand.
And it may not seem like it, but I'm running around up there.
Oh, yeah, no, I get that. I've done a comedy humorous show live on stage called Shalom Damn It. And I'm 14 pounds lighter when I... Oh, yeah, Shalom Damn It. It was wonderful. Go watch it on YouTube. But why can't you have a beer at a bar? You can start pishing on stage, or does it affect your head, or what?
No, the prostate thing is not a problem on stage. During the day, I can handle that. I have found that peeing three times a night is highly effective means of home security. But I'm able to. I need to have water, so I'm hydrated, and coffee, so I'm a little amped, and a little bit of sugar, either a cookie or a half a candy bar or something before I go on stage.
Now, you are very much a topical, political comedian. So every time you go on, you're like Mort Saul. You have to check the newspaper. You have to be up on what happened that day. How do you make sure that you're funny about something that just happened 5 hours ago?
Yeah, exactly. That's the conundrum. It's hard. You know what I found, though? I found that the audience is very forgiving, that as long as you mention it, you don't necessarily have to have a joke about it. You know, if I were one of the talk show guys, you know, and they're all really good, Colbert and Seth Meyer and, you know, Kimmel and all the Jimmys, they're all really, really good. But there's also, you know, very providential that they have 15 writers.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they have a lot of guys working on that. Now I have to work stuff out and then their skill is that they see that joke maybe three times before they present it to a national audience. And that's tough, man. I mean, once during the major call when everybody, you know, out their jokes of the day, and then when they type it down, and then third, it's on the teleprompter. You know, and that's the third time they've seen that joke all day, and they're delivering it to a national audience. Well, me, I have to write everything, mostly because I can't afford writers, so I have to do everything myself, and also I kind of come from a journalism background a little bit.
So, but also, you see the joke once. I mean, you think of it, you write it on maybe a note card or just the idea of it. You don't have the luxury of seeing it three times during the day before you're performing at 8 o'clock.
No, it's exactly the opposite. I work on that joke and work on that joke and work on that joke all day long. And when it hits the stage, and then on stage, it changes. I will find a different timing on that joke. So the joke really doesn't, you know, grip itself into the DNA of the act until at least a weekend.
That makes sense. Do you carry, like, little notes or note cards on stage that you glance at? Because, you know, I always wondered how stand-up comedians who go from topic to topic to topic don't... They never look like they were looking at anything. Nowadays, everybody reads from monitors if they're famous. But how did you manage that all these years, especially when you have to change 50% of material night to night?
Well, it's not 50%. I have an overarching theme. I found that if I get caught up in the minutiae of the day's news, that it will just pass me by, and I never get a chance to hone it, and then it's over. For instance, I made the mistake of doing like 5 minutes on Anthony Scaramucci, and that's not just ancient history. I mean, that's medieval at this point. Those jokes are wearing a breastplate, you know. So, and the same thing with Omarosa. So my stuff about Trump, and there is topical stuff, but my stuff is more of an overarching theme covering the whole thing. So it's semi-permanent. The act is semi-permanent with little holes, pigeonholes for current topical stuff. And yeah, I use an overhead projector. So I throw Omarosa up there on the overhead projector, and just that's a quick joke. Wilbur Mills, I'm working on a joke about Wilbur Mills. And so,
Wait, Wilbur Mills from Watergate? Who the hell's Wilbur Mills? Wait.
Exactly. He's the Secretary of Commerce. He's the guy that Forbes magazine said possibly stole $120 million from clients before he became Secretary of Commerce. And the guy is so cheap that he pockets packets of Sweet and Low at restaurants so he doesn't have to buy it at home.
Oh, I do that. I do the blue packets, the yellow pack. I do whatever. I take little bitty containers and squirt the ketchup in there as well. There's gravy left over on the plate.
But we used to call soup.
Oh, that's right, ketchup at the automat for people who couldn't afford. I'm old enough to understand that reference. But you also make it...
You also apparently were broke enough to understand that reference.
I'm broke enough now to understand that reference, goddammit. Oh, my God. Please. And, you know, if I didn't have a synagogue, I wouldn't have a place to sleep. Let me tell you, these are tough times. But for you, it's been a really good time making a career in stand-up, even though you're probably more local than a lot of other people who go out there. They do the TV, they do international stuff, and you, would you say that like 75% of the time you're in the San Francisco area?
Yeah, I think that's about the right number. Used to be half and half. I used to go out a lot more often, but what I did was I found that I got too old for the comedy clubs. The average age of a comedy club is 18 to 35, which was great when I was 18 to 35. But now, there's always some kid comic doing giant genital jokes before me, or some sort of Asian, you know, like masturbation or defecation or some sort of... It's impossible to get the audience to turn around and listen to political material. It takes forever for me to turn the Titanic. So I kind of got... And I'm not famous enough that they come see me on purpose, you know. But a couple people, maybe 20, 30% of the audience knows who I am.
Okay. That's
the rest, rest of them just wander in because it's a comedy club. So, you know, it's So I decided this way, doing the little one-man show, I can control the whole thing. I can control the pre-show music, the set, the lighting. So I've been doing this. I did a show in 2006 in New York. It was called the All-American Sport of Bipartisan Bashing. And ever since then, I've just been doing little one-man shows at theaters. And so I run at a theater here in San Francisco, and I do every Tuesday at the theater. And then on weekends, I take it out on the road, and I have a circuit of theaters here in the Bay Area, and in Wisconsin, and in Washington, and in Nevada, and not so much Oregon, but I'm angling to get there. But I have all these little theaters that put me up between Death of a Salesman and My Fair Lady, and, you know, they get a weekend there. So I do it on a percentage basis, so they have some skin in the game, and they send me out on their subscription mailing list, and I've been earning a living doing this.
So I was wondering about that, because even what's really cool about the Playroom Theater is, I took a look at it, it looks like it's got about 60, 70 seats total. So after the rental and all of that, you are able to more than break even. You make a little bit of a dough, as you say.
Yeah, I'm real low maintenance, you know, so yeah, I keep the cost down. I bring in everything myself.
Now, do you, I'm just curious because I'm so broke, do have, when you do your podcasts and your blogging, are you making any money off that sort of thing, or is it just to bring attention to your brand when you physically go out and perform?
Yeah, I make a little. I do commentaries for 15 radio stations once a week. People can hear those commentaries by going to my website, wilders.com. And then I turn that commentary, that's about 300 words, I turn that commentary into a column every week that gets syndicated through an organization called Kegel Cartoons. And people can see that at wilders.com, too. So, yeah, and it forces me to write. And I'm, you know, I'm still in high school, man. If it's due Monday morning, I start it Sunday after 60 minutes, you know.
Well, you have to, because the kind of stuff you write, if you wrote the previous Thursday, the news would be ancient already.
You don't know how often that happens, man. How often, by the time I finish a weekly column, and the news has been superseded by other news.
Yeah, it's the truth. But here's also what I'm kind of interested in. I get the sense that for the most part of your career, you were able to, you hit both sides. In other words, whether you're Republican or Democrat, you go out there and you make fun of the news and whatever politician was in power. So if Obama was the president, you make fun of that administration. If you know, but now, did you end up shifting further to the left just because it's been so insane?
No, I didn't shift to the left. I stayed in the same damn place, and they moved the playing field. I started at the 40-yard line of the liberals. I'm a third-generation factory rat from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You know, my dad was a union steward, and yeah, we believed in the workers and stuff. But I was on the and the Republicans kept yanking the playing field. I'm on the goal line. I'm on the 2-yard now. And yes, you're right. I announced this in the show that I have totally abandoned any efforts to be bipartisan, because America spoke and I listened, and I'm going to go after him the same way he went after us. I'm playing by his rules.
Oh my! All right. Is there? I know you are trying. Of course, you're a comedian. You need to be funny. But is there so much anger now that it's harder, or does the anger just make it vicious, like in the Richard Nixon days?
Well, it's hard to parody a parody. That's the biggest problem with Trump. Because there's something every day, yeah. Every new outrage. I wonder if we're going to go into Trump fatigue. You would have thought it would happen already, you know, after 3 years or 3 decades or whatever we've been under his.
Well, I think it is actually a fatigue point, because his rating level is getting higher. You know, the economy has been good, and people are just so sick of the bashing and the back and forth and the anger that they're just, all right, look, we're used to him. We may vote for him for another 4 years. That's partially fatigue, I think.
That's, I think you, unfortunately, may be right, yeah.
And it's also the fact that, you know, we don't, as terrible as things have been, we're not in the middle of a big war and the economy. So we concentrate on all the stupid things he says and all the dumb things he does, while at the same time, life kind of goes on and we're okay.
Yeah, right now, but these things are going to have a cumulative effect. I mean, the deficit that he just built up, and you know, Republicans are going to come by and say, well, you know, we got this deficit, we can't have the deficit, so we're going to have to get rid of entitlements. So it's the prelude right now, and dumping coal ash in the streams in West Virginia. Well, that's up to West Virginia, but still.
West Virginia makes Kool-Aid. Come on, you know.
Coal ash Kool-Aid. I like that.
Yeah, thank you. But also, let's roll it back a little. Let's roll it back. When did you realize that you could amuse people? That you were funny? Were you like 5 years old?
You know what, Rabbi? What happened was I got a brother who. Developmentally disabled. We used to call him mentally retarded, but Marky, my brother. Mm. So he couldn't speak, he couldn't understand, couldn't vocalize. I mean, he could laugh and point, and you know, he's one of the most darling kids you ever. And he's a kid. He's 2 years younger than mine. I am, so he's in his 60s, you know. But Marky. The currency in our family was making Marky laugh. If you could make Marky laugh, he would feel part of the family. And, you know, we were all one. So that was the currency around the kitchen table. And we all made Marky laugh, and we did it through vocal tricks, and my dad was hysterical, and my mom was very funny and an artist, and so... We just started, that was an everyday thing, you know?
Wow. And let me ask you, at some point you decided to take it more professionally and seriously. What do you remember learning from being with Paul Sills and those improv-y and sketch-type people?
He taught me to work at the top of my brain, to never underestimate the audience. Always be as smart as you can on stage.
No, that's a, you know, you're talking about, because quite honestly, like, if you roll back 40 years and then Steve Martin at the height of his fame when he was playing arenas, he basically had to tailor his material to 50,000 Markies in the audience. Put on a little bunny ears, and he's a brilliant
man. But you can remember what a cultural shift that was, because, you know, during the, after Kennedy was assassinated, and then the Vietnam, and comedy kind of died there for a while, and you weren't allowed to be, you know, there was the politically correct police, and you had to, you know, in order to be a comic, and Carlin and Pryor, and you gotta say something, and then Steve Martin made Goofy funny again, you know?
That's
he
true.
And Robin Williams.
Well, in terms of influences on you, it's kind of obvious, or maybe too obvious, to say Mort Saul was number one, but maybe it was Jackie Mason or Lenny Bruce. Whom did you look up to?
Leonard Albert Schneider, I think he was number one.
That's Lenny Bruce, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because?
Just because of, I don't know. Maybe it had something to do with the, you know, the whole martyr thing, you know. And also his material was so literate and cinematic. I mean, he had all those little movie parodies he would do, and it was just and he was the smartest and bravest, and especially the what was it, Live at the Curran, or was it Berkeley? But a couple of his albums, you know, his live albums were just, or the one at Carnegie, the one that was a midnight concert at Carnegie with the snowstorm.
Hmm. Okay. Because that's, I've always found that to be the problem with Lenny Bruce, is that we lionize him and kind of all the shots that he took for the team in terms of being able to speak what we want to speak as humorists. But at the same time, the recorded material that you see of him on TV or some of the albums, you sit there and you listen and you say, well, I guess this was funny for 1957, but... dot, dot. No, as opposed to the Carlin albums from the 1970s, that you play them for someone who's never heard them, and they're absolutely on the floor hysterical. You know?
It's Daniel Boone versus, the guy who... I mean, think of what it was like before Letty Bruce. You know, it was mother-in-law jokes. It was airplane food jokes. So, I mean, Carlin had a much larger pathway because the machete had already been used in the jungle, you know?
True. Very, very true indeed. So, did you ever, by the way, see Bruce live? Your old...
No.
So...
He died in 66. I was 12.
Oh, all right. I guess my math was off on that. Were there any comedians, legends that you have seen?
I was at Summerfest when George Carlin got busted for saying the seven words.
Oh.
That was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And was that a moment
outdoor
that galvanized...
concert.
I'm sorry. But was that a moment that galvanized you as a comedian? Of like, you know, this brave guy, I'm going to do that.
No, I wasn't a comic yet, but I wanted to be a comic. My mother says that when I was 6 years old, I asked her where I could go to school to become a stand-up comic. And I would stay up and watch all the comics on The Tonight Show and, you know, Midwest. It was an hour earlier, so I had a better shot at it. And then I studied theater and journalism and film in school, so I kind of triangulated it. And, you know, because I wrote my own stuff, and I had been on stage, so I wasn't freaked out because of that.
Yeah.
And theater, I knew a little bit about walking around the stage, and film, I had... Yeah, so when I started doing stand-up, I was already pretty good, because my material was... I used to write a humor column for the local underground newspaper in Milwaukee, so I had an idea of what jokes were like.
Well,
I'm still a writer who performs. I'm not a pure stand-up like some guys, you know, Greg Proops and Bobby Slayton and stuff. You know?
Well, they would still do clubs, and you do theaters in that specific way. The nice thing about theater is not every joke has to land. Because it's like, it's not a comedy club. That didn't really have to be funny. That's just setting up some funny stuff 5 minutes from now. Whereas,
No. That's not me. I'm
no?
funny. Everything is funny. No, every line is funny. Every line is a setup. That's one of my problems is there's too many jokes that I wear the audience out.
What a terrible problem to have.
It is, man, when you're doing 90 minutes and they start wilting after 35 because you've told so many jokes and put so much pressure on them to follow along. Yeah, it is a bitch.
But even the master comedians, they know that you have these peaks and valleys, and if you get them laughing hysterically in the first 15 minutes, it's just fatigue. We keep you coming back to that word. You kind of have to do a downslope in some of the lesser material, then you bring them back up for a bit, and then you got to close really strong. That's...
Lesser material? What are you talking about, lesser material? You know, you're talking about judging your children? No. They're all equally wonderful in their own way.
Speaking of children, I'm just curious about this, and I'm sorry to ask, but I figure our audience is, and your family and all that. Are you in any way related to either the Durst organization or the crazy, the woman killer, Durst?
Cousin Bobby? No. No, we're not related to Cousin Bobby or his father Seymour, who owns most of Times Square. Alas.
Yeah, right. That would be. Then you would have your own string of theaters, and it would be fantastic. But
yeah. I'd be taking this on the road.
Exactly. Hey, let me also ask, though, by the way, I want to remind people, we're talking to Will Durst, not of the Durst family, and not of the Durst murderers. He's just the Durst, the blogger, the comedian, the satirist, the radio host, and the guy that you can go see November 7th through the 18th at the Playroom Theater in Midtown Manhattan. It's West 46th Street near 6th Avenue. For more information about him and all the stuff that he's recorded and that you can read and his blog and the comic script thing, it's willdurst.com. Will, D-U-R-S-T, willdurst.com. So, you've been on television a million times. Did you ever try for that brass ring of, the sitcom, the funny next-door neighbor thing, or that was just never in the cards?
Was it a focus? No, I did have a show on A&E when A&E was the comedy Nazi channel. I don't know if you remember those days.
No, really, no.
Like 94, and we did a show called A Year's Worth with Will Durst, and we were going to turn it into A Week's Worth with Will Durst, and we were nominated for a Cable Ace. It was a pretty good show, and that's when A&E decided to get out of the comedy business.
Oh, that's right. You did this Ace show. You got an award, and they canceled your show. Amazing. Amazing. How do you bounce back from setbacks like that?
You know what I do? I watch Duck Soup.
Best Marx Brothers, easily the best Marx Brothers movie, but maybe the top three comedy ever made.
I think so, too. This is what happened. I had a gig down in L.A. I was going to be on this TV show with Louis Anderson, and I was going to resuscitate my national televised career, and they called up the day before it aired, it was supposed to tape, and said, we're going in a different direction. I had bought my ticket to go to L.A. and reserved a room and was all set up. And, man, I was so depressed. And I put in Duck Soup. I just, because I own it, I think two copies of it. I put in Duck Soup and...
And there it is.
I was fine, you know. 2 hours later, wasn't fine, but the edge was off, you know. I put the knife down.
That's I mean, you know, that's literally the moment in the Woody Allen movie. I think it was not Hanging Sisters, but the one that came after, where he's all depressed and suicidal. And what does he go to see? He goes to see Duck Soup in the movies.
Oh, I thought it was Sorrow and the Pity.
That was Annie Hall, and they missed the first minute of it. And, you know, you don't walk into a movie when the first minute's over. It just ruins the whole experience.
That's right. Good one, Rabbit.
Now, do you... Sitting home, and do you watch people like Colbert and Bill Maher and John Oliver?
Oh, I don't. I can't. I'm a sponge. And, you know, I'm the kind of guy that I'll see something incredibly funny, and unless I mark it as somebody else's, it may, you know, just ooze into my subconscious and gurgle up later. I can't watch any of those shows.
That makes total sense. Also, since it's so topical there, that you're going to...
Exactly. That's the other thing that happens is, you know, they'll hit on the exact same subject that I'm working on with a similar line, and now I have the dilemma, do I go out on stage with this line even though I know I wrote it, or am I... Because I approach it different. If I worry that the audience might think I took it from somewhere else, and I don't have the same kind of confidence, so it's just better for me not to know.
Are there one or two or three jokes that you've written over, God, 30, 40 years now, that are your absolute treasured favorite gems?
You know what? Eyes are always focused forward, and once in a while, a friend of mine will come up. I used to do a joke about Clinton, no matter what you thought of his policies, you had to admire his ability not to get involved in them. And I thought it was a pretty good joke, and I totally forgot about it. And a friend of mine, also a political comedian, also in the Bay Area, his name is Nate O'Green, very funny young man, very funny. He actually wrote on the W. Kamau Bell show, Unbiased. Totally unbiased.
Yeah.
So he was in New York for a long time. But he told me, you should do that with Obama. And I did. And it worked out. But no, I don't even... I just keep going forward.
Well, that's... Actually, is it okay to recycle jokes for new people? Like, you can take Nixon jokes, or certainly George W. Bush jokes, and refashion them for Trump. You know, if you talk about the mutilated Saudi Arabian journalist guy, there's probably someone who was killed in an embassy 25 years ago. You may have made a joke about it. Do you go poking through the archives?
You know, that's a great thing about surviving so long is you can rip yourself off. Yeah, go through old notebooks. I did a joke about Bush, and the joke was... George Bush is a Wheel of Fortune president in a Jeopardy world.
Oh.
So I changed that. the Wheel of Fortune president in a Jeopardy world, but this guy is chutes and ladders.
And it works. You just tinker with it a little bit, and it still goes. Now, did you learn anything? I read somewhere that back in the day, you ran for mayor of San Francisco?
Yeah, it was kind of a publicity stunt, I figured.
It was like a Pat Paulson thing more than a real thing.
Yeah. But then I would go to those candidate forums and be a member of the candidate forums, and the little old ladies would get pissed at me when they realized that I was making a mockery of the whole thing. So then I started taking it serious, and some of the candidates, I got 2% of the vote. I came in fourth out of 11.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
I wish our football team at the local university was that good. Let me tell you, not too terrible. All right. And can I also ask that some of your podcasts and some of the things you do involve a woman? Ooh. Now, I am helped all the time. My darling and adorable wife, we have 21 and a half beautiful children together. So your wife is very helpful to you.
My wife is much funnier than I am, which pisses me off not less than somewhat. She's an improviser, though. She doesn't do stand-up. And we work together 3 or 4 times a year. At the end of the year, we do a big tour of the Bay Area called the Big Fat Year-End Kiss-Off Comedy Show. And it's her and her partner. She does improv with a partner. Deb and Mike, they're called. And then we have another headliner from town here named Johnny Steele and Mari Magaloni and Arthur Gauss. And we hit like 10 different cities in 10 days starting the day after Christmas. And then we go on vacation.
Wow, that sounds like a tremendous amount of fun. But don't you do podcasts and things with her more often? Or you say you work together only 4 times a year?
Oh, we used to do a little TV show. It was called Phil and Linda's Dog Show, starring Will and Debbie as Ed and Kathy. And it was a little cable access show, and I think we did a couple of years. I think there's like 50 episodes. And I've been trying to put that up on the web.
Yeah, please do. But please put it at willdurst.com, where people can read all the things. You've got a vault there of all your older stuff, plus, of course, the new blog and the podcast and the things that you do. Well, why else should people surf willdurst.com?
Oh, I don't know. I do have a cautionary note to inject, and that's there's a warning about my little show about the Durst case scenario, midterm madness, at the little playroom theater, November 7th through 18th. Tickets available at Eventbrite. But I do have a warning, and the warning is, if you think the current occupant of the Oval Office is a breath of fresh air, this show is not for you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you've made it clear that, you swung left as soon as Donald Trump came into... I mean, you were already left from a union family, but you had to swing even further because you were pushed there, as it were. Hey, here's the last... I hope this doesn't turn into a dark, unfunny question, but I kind of want to go there. Since we've been a comedian for so long, and I made a little funny about... a journalist who was dismembered, and some people may be like, oh, God, how can you joke? What did you do after 9/11?
I was supposed to go to the New Orleans Comedy Festival, so I still hold Osama bin Laden responsible for denying me a week in New Orleans. But Louis Black was supposed to come out to San Francisco, and he couldn't get out here. So I filled in for him at Cobb's Comedy Club here in San Francisco. And it was so bizarre because, it happened on a Tuesday. We skipped Wednesday. We took Wednesday off. And then we started shows on Thursday. And crowds were hungry to laugh. I mean, they really needed something. And the first two comics totally ignored what had gone on. And it just seemed so jarring, and I think the audience audience found it jarring. And I went up and I talked about the coverage mostly, you know, that I remember I had a joke about MSNBC had a crawl at the bottom that New York City reports no unusual looting. Well, apparently it was just the normal Tuesday night load, you know. So I did coverage, something, because everybody had watched TV for 2 days straight. Yeah. So we all had that shared reference. And I remember doing at least a half an hour on that.
Well, that's the thing. Is there stuff that you won't touch? If something is really horrible, is there always a way to make funny of it? Even, or maybe if you wait 48 hours at least.
My theory is you punch up, that you make fun of people who are more powerful than you. You know, it's hard for me to do jokes about people, and I don't like seeing them either, jokes about people who are less fortunate.
Well, pretty much I'm less fortunate than everyone, so I can punch up anybody.
Well, with 21 and a half kids,
oh, yeah.
That's a lot of mouths to feed, Rabbi.
And I'm already less important than they are to my dear wife, Miriam Libby, so that's just the way it goes. But it has been, I've been punching above my weight to be able to talk to you.
Pshaw, Rabbi, the honor has been mine.
Oh, thank you, thank you. It's Will Durst. Everybody, please go see him in Durst Case Scenario at the Playroom Theater. It's this wonderful, intimate, like 60, 70, so it's not like he's going to be on a big monitor and you're watching the Rolling Stones from a million miles away. He's right there telling these jokes in front of you at the Playroom Theater on West 46th Street, November 7th through the 18th. For more information, for all the information, go to willdurst.com. It just remains for me to say that it has been so fun and so funny, and I hope you will come back to the neighborhood again for more of this, because it's just been great.
I had a wonderful time. This has been a joy, Rabbi. Thank you so much for letting me play your little reindeer games.
Oh, and thank you. Well, that's a little too much of a Goyesha reference right there, but we'll accept it. From Will Durst, shalom to you.
Shalom, Rabbi.